Okay, so the date is Sunday, November 2nd, 1997. It's roughly 2 weeks before my 10th birthday. That Sunday was unlike all the rest of them because that Sunday night was a broadcast of an updated version of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella. I sat in church all that Sunday just like wriggling with joy because I knew that later on tonight I was going to be able to see Brandy as Cinderella and Whitney Houston as the fairy godmother. So I'm sitting in the living room with my family and immediately on the screen, Whitney Houston. She's setting up the prologue. She's getting us started.
Impossible for a plain yellow pumpkin to become a golden carriage. Impossible.
But I'm still sitting there like, where is Brandy? I need to see Brandy. About 5 or so minutes into the broadcast, like, the scene opens up. Like, it's obviously some sort of, like, magical fairy tale land. And there's, like, all of these people, all different races and ethnicities and ages, because they did the whole thing colorblind casting. You hear this music start, and you know something's about to happen, and then you see Brandy, who still has all of her micro braids. Like, she's in this fairy tale land, and she has all of her micro braids, and she starts singing The Sweetest Sounds, which is, like, the very first song where, like, she and Prince Charming are both singing separately. They haven't found each other yet, but they're singing separately about, like, pining for their true love.
The sweetest sounds I'll ever hear are still inside my head.
The kind. I mean, I had never seen a Black Disney princess before, let alone a Black Cinderella. And it just blew my mind. I wasn't used to seeing, like, people that resembled me, like little Black girls, as, like, the center of a story. And it's like, I mean, it's like a night that I couldn't possibly forget. And I didn't have to forget it because I made my parents tape it. I watched it probably at least every week for a year or so. Looking back on it, I can recognize it as the first time that I really felt represented in the media. From Gimlet Media, this is Sampler, and I'm your host, Brittany Luce. So, fall is upon us yet again, and for many of you, that means, like, leaves are changing, and your kids are going back to school, and it's pumpkin spice time. Full disclosure, I actually like pumpkin spice flavored things. But for me, you know, just the fun-loving woman that I am, my focus every fall returns to representation in the media. It's like we have a new slate of fall TV shows, beginning of awards season, and it gets me thinking about, you know, whether things in Hollywood are actually getting any better. And so I started looking for podcasts that might have some answers. And I was so excited to come across this new podcast called Represent. It's hosted by Aisha Harris, who is a longtime culture writer at Slate. And it's really one of the only shows that I found that focuses solely on film and TV creators who typically are the people who get, like, the token treatment in Hollywood. You know what I mean? Like LGBT people, people of color, women, or any combination of those things. Like, Aisha actually does a deep dive into them, their craft, and what they're interested in. You know, while some shows kind of dance around difficult topics, Aisha really faces them head on. And her guests don't shy away from taking a stance on things either. Like, you know, say cisgender male actors playing trans women or cross-racial voiceovers.
I'm Aisha Harris, a culture writer for Slate, and I'm excited to be your guide through this safe space of discussion, questioning, and perhaps the occasional venting about Hollywood and how it treats those of us who don't happen to be straight white dudes.
And that's one of the reasons why I like Aisha. She just puts it right out there. So I figured that she would be my perfect co-host for today to help guide you guys through some of the best podcast moments about the topic of representation. So today with me in the studio, we have staff writer at Slate.com and also the host of the newly launched Represent podcast, Aisha Harris.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Welcome to Sampler, Aisha.
Thanks.
So the first podcast I want to talk to you about today is actually your own, Represent. Could you walk me through what you think the podcast is about?
Sure. The podcast is a show in which I explore film and TV through the perspective of anyone who's not a straight white guy, essentially. And for me, part of it was I didn't want to just focus on Black film and TV. Mm-hmm. I think it's easy for me to focus on that just because that is my... That's what I know the best because I am a Black woman.
Yeah.
But I wanted to, you know, not limit myself so much and be able to talk with other people who are, you know, identify as queer or LGBT. And I also want to talk very deeply about what they do and how it relates to representation. Like the meaty big part of the show is the sit down with someone who works in the industry who is falls within a typically underrepresented group.
So one of those people you talked to was somebody that I've admired for a long time who spoke really candidly with you about something that recently just didn't work out for him, and that's mm-hmm. Larry Wilmore.
Yeah.
Really quickly, Larry Wilmore was the host of The Nightly Show on Comedy Central, which was just recently canceled. And you guys were having this phone conversation about what went wrong and where... He feels like viewers and the network may have let him down.
So we really felt like a nice well-oiled machine. We just felt like we weren't getting all the viewers we were like, you know. So that could be very frustrating. You know, it's part of television. We're not the only show that has had that happen. It's, you know, that type of thing can happen. So
yeah.
Because it's a different, let me put it this way. Mm-hmm. It's a completely different feeling when you're on a show and you know you're not doing it, you know, where you're going, this show is just not working. Mm-hmm. We just can't, I don't know what it is. Like, that's a different feeling. For us, it felt the opposite. It felt like, nobody's seeing what we're doing, you know.
Right.
That's what it felt like to us. So.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem like not giving you enough time to sort of, or do you feel as if they didn't give you enough time, especially since the elections were coming up?
Yeah.
Because it would have been nice to see what you guys would do. And plus, it's just like that's the time when, no matter what show it is, whether it's The Daily Show, I imagine all of those shows, they get a boost when the elections happen.
I personally felt that way. I expressed that I was very disappointed that they didn't try to promote our shows together. Mm. We were two Black men in late night doing smart comedy shows. That hasn't happened before. And I was really upset that we never did any mutual promotion and really tied the shows together. You know, the way John and Stephen, when Stephen was doing Colbert, you know.
Exactly.
They did a lot of cross-promotion. You saw the relationship between the two people, which was so much fun. And I thought we could have gotten so much mileage out of Trevor and I having that type of relationship on the air. I'm an African-American. He's an African-African, you know. I could be teasing about that, whatever.
Yeah.
But at least people would know that there's a distinction between us as personalities, and then they would see the distinction between the shows, you know.
Right. Do you have any feeling that maybe part of the issue was, and you've spoken a bit about this before, is, and you've joked about it, the fact that, you know, your show was very, you center race and especially Blackness within your comedy, and it makes people uncomfortable. And do you think maybe the idea of having two Black guys, even though you guys have a totally different way of doing humor and comedy, do you think that the idea of putting you two together maybe scared off the network and they were afraid that people wouldn't buy that?
I don't know if they were afraid. I don't know if that's the case. I think the unconsciously, the audience could have felt they might have been getting the same thing and could say, well, why do I need to stick around for this? That's possible. You never know, right?
Like, when I heard that, it sort of brought to light to me one of the things that I think in, when I think about, like, the larger conversation about representation, I think that, like, ideas about audience participation and sort of like how audiences interact with a product or interact with a film or a television show, like I feel like that is sort of left out of the conversation a lot of the time.
Yeah. I know so many people who told me, you know, I'm really sad that the show is gone, but I never really watched it. And there was some sort of disconnect. And I think part of it is just that, you know, people aren't really watching late night.
Like, you know, it used to be just like, I'm at home, this is what's on, this is what I'm going to unwind to before I go to sleep.
Right.
And now it's sort of like you can do anything. Like, you can lay in your bed with one eye open and just look at Snapchat.
Exactly.
There are so many more ways to consume media now. And like as a result of that, there's also so many more spaces that you can use to critique it. You know, like I feel like in podcasting, there's like an abundance of criticism. Like sometimes it can feel like everybody is a critic. How do you think that affects the space?
Really, like any other space, when everyone is making their critiques, there are going to be some people who don't think as hard about those critiques before they make them, which can create a toxic space to some extent. But I think then there are also people who do really think deeply about, like one of my favorite podcasts that I've been listening to for, they were actually the first podcast I started listening to when I discovered podcasts were a thing. Mm-hmm. It's called Film Spotting. They've been around for, I think, about a decade.
Yeah.
And granted, it's two white guys, Adam Campanar and Josh Larson. But they're also very smart. They just are really thoughtful, and they will often acknowledge their shortcomings, and whether it's their own film knowledge. Like, they have a very, to me, I think they have a very robust film knowledge. But, you know, they don't know no one knows everything. And so when they're talking about a movie that might be a little bit out of their normal, you know, purview, they will admit that.
So just to get a sense of what Film Spotting sounds like, let's hear Josh and Adam talk about whether or not the movie Mad Max Fury Road is, quote unquote, feminist. So just some context, Mad Max Fury Road is pretty female-centric, and there are a lot of, like, women playing main characters. So the first voice you're going to hear in this clip is Josh's.
Even with this emphasis on female characters, though, some aren't so sure about Fury Road's feminist credentials. On Twitter, Anita Sarkeesian, host of the web series Feminist Frequency, bluntly declared, "I saw Fury Road, I get why people like it, but it isn't feminist." One of the reasons she gave in a series of tweets was this: "Feminism doesn't simply mean women getting to partake in typical badass guy stuff. Feminism is about redefining our social value system." So, Adam, where do you fall on the question of whether or not Mad Max Fury Road is feminist? Or do you think that this debate itself has hijacked a movie that is at its core just a brilliant take-no-prisoners action flick?
Well, I guess the question I put back on you, Josh, is can I say that it's not a feminist movie, but still like the movie? I think that may be the more challenging question to answer. And when she says it isn't feminist, it makes me think that there's almost this checklist for art, and the movie either checks those boxes, however many there are, or it doesn't check the boxes. And if it doesn't check all of them, can we still appreciate what it's doing versus what it isn't doing? And so let's put a movie like Fury Road in the context of the other Mad Max films. In both of them, I think we can pretty much say, blanket statement, all the women are peripheral characters at best. Some of them are sort of sexual sidekicks to these scavengers, these gangs out there. Or in the first Mad Max, she's basically a helpless spouse and a helpless mom. You put that in contrast to this movie. You have the whole plot based around these women no longer wanting to be objects and searching for a way out of this system of oppression. That's a far cry from anything we saw in the first two Mad Max movies, and more than what we see in most Hollywood action movies. So is that then not enough?
I think it depends on who's asking the question, right? And you and I are both coming at it as movie people first, or let's say as text-oriented film lovers, not someone from feminist film theory or any sort of political film theory or any sort of ideology.
Sure.
And if you are looking at the film through that lens first, you may be holding it up to standards and saying, because I'm aware of this, I like to call attention to these, what are important concerns. This is why I like reading people who have this perspective on films. That's what you're going to draw upon. I'm just a boy watching a movie, hoping it does right by its girls.
Mm-hmm.
They are probably one of the smartest critics that are doing the sort of thing.
That means a lot coming from you, you know, because you love film and you're also a really serious critic yourself.
Okay.
No, I mean, I'm serious. You can hear it in the way that you talk. I can hear it in episodes of Represent. Like, you're so knowledgeable about the projects that you review, and you really get into the nitty-gritty of technique and story structure. Like, you're obviously a critic, but I saw on Twitter, like recently you named your fave seven films.
Yes.
And you had like the most sentimental sort of list.
Oh, yeah.
Where, like, I mean, it was like Little Mermaid, Singing in the Rain, Goodfellas. Like, you had so many quintessential choices on your list. Like, I didn't get the sense that you were trying to put on airs and be like, I am a critic. So, like, these are my seven favorite films.
Yeah, I try not to. You know, I definitely went through that phase in my life where it was like, oh, I'm too serious for this. Let's analyze and only talk about auteurs and all that crap. So I probably around 10 or 11 when I first watched Singing in the Rain is when I discovered Turner Classic Movies. And I prided myself on watching Turner Classic Movies and watching foreign films. But now I realize some of the movies I love the most are like Mean Girls. I think Mean Girls like could stand up as one of the best comedies of the last 15 years.
I totally, easily. 100% easily. Agree. To me, a favorite movie is something where if it's on Saturday, you're not moving. Do you know what I mean?
Like, exactly.
It's if you get 45 minutes in and you like happen to see that it's playing on TBS with commercials, you're like, well, I have to sit and finish this entire thing.
Right.
Okay, so we're going to take a quick break, but when we return, we're going to hear from one of my favorite movie makers, and we're also going to talk about the power of the oh my God moment. All right, so we are back from our little break. I am in the studio with Aisha Harris from Represent Podcast at Slate.
Hello.
Hello, Aisha.
Hello again.
So I want to pick up where we left off in our conversation about representation and play you some clips that kind of capture what some TV and film creators have to say.
Cool.
So the first clip is from someone who, like, I mean, she's everything to me. And also, she's just like exactly the type of role model that I sorely needed when I was in film school. And that's director Ava DuVernay. Like, there aren't even words that describe my love for her. I just think she's so fantastic.
She's amazing.
So I'm actually going to play you a clip that features Ava. So for those of you guys who don't know, Ava DuVernay is a director and screenwriter. And she directed Selma. So Selma is a historical drama about Martin Luther King Jr. and the voting rights marches that went from Selma, Alabama to Montgomery, Alabama in 1965. And in this particular clip, she's on this show called The Treatment, which is from one of NPR's LA stations, KCRW, and it's hosted by the critic Elvis Mitchell. So on the show, he has really frank conversations with major figures in the entertainment industry like Ava DuVernay. So we're going to pick right up when Ava and Elvis are talking about the gaze of the director or the director's perspective and how that can affect a film. So the first voice you're going to hear is Elvis Mitchell's.
One of the things that you use a lot, and it always shocks me how rarely people bring this up, is the way you use silence. Mm. In film. And I also feel like that's a kind of a radical thing too, because again, so many films about black characters, they're always explaining themselves as if somehow nobody can figure them out. They're not talking about who they are and what they're doing at all times.
That's right. That's right. I mean, it's exhausting and it's reductive and it's just why are we doing it? It's just my point of view. I feel like Morissette in The Silences, and I like to play with that as much as possible. And just, you know, even in scenes, my editor Spencer and Averick and I just try to figure, how long can we push this where no one's saying anything? And when you have actors like David Oyelowo and Carmen and all these wonderful people, the geography of the face sometimes says so much more than a bunch of dialogue that's, you know, dictating exactly where one goes. The other thing about silence is, you know, it allows you to fill in the blanks a little bit. I mean, I don't have to dictate your feelings at every moment. You know, I even like silence to the point where it's not just absent of dialogue, but also of music. Just sit there with it for a second. And that's not anything new, but it is not as common in films with black folk.
See, because one of the things we're talking about, that gaze, and so often in that gaze, because they want to understand people of color themselves, they're having these people explain to both themselves and to the audience.
I think it's ridiculous. I mean, yes, that is the thought. And I know for a fact people people who love film, surely. You know, we're used to seeing all kinds of films. We're used to seeing everything. It's just this, the simplification that goes with the Black cinematic image, that there has to be this ongoing explanation and this ongoing, you know, proof of our presence and why we're there. And it's too much. I think we're past that point.
I wish we were. It doesn't happen often enough for me to say we're past that point.
We're past the point, I think, intellectually in terms of filmmakers, film lovers, film watchers. I don't know if all filmmakers and the people that control film and that are giving notes on films have caught up with the way that people really feel as they're consuming the film. It's complicated, but I'm glad that you bring it up, because, you know, silence with Black and brown faces on a film is radical, and the fact that that is at this point is really a shame.
I love her so much. She gets it. And yeah, the idea of silence on film with Black bodies, I think, is just so powerful.
A scene of hers that comes to mind for me is the one from Selma, when Coretta, who's Martin's wife, Coretta and Martin are sitting in their living room listening to a recording from this racist man who is harassing Martin with a sex tape of an alleged affair.
The American public will soon know you for what you are, an evil, abnormal beast. That wasn't me. That isn't me, Corey.
I know. I know what you sound like.
There are so many instances I can think of in lots of films featuring Black people where that scene would have been played all the way up. But instead you have like these long pauses in between dialogue. And, you know, as the viewer, you start noticing other details, like, you know, Coretta's hands are neatly folded in her lap, and you see that her eyes are watering. And I really appreciated that Coretta's response kind of matched what you would expect from, like, a genteel Southern preacher's wife.
Yeah.
So another point Ava brought up in that clip is the difference between film lovers and film makers. Like, what can the audience, like, actually do to seek out and support more diverse voices and stories in filmmaking?
Yeah. I mean, I think that now that we have more streaming services and more options for watching films, I think definitely that's been a win for film lovers. But I do think that, yes, film lovers to some extent will see everything, but what do they value? And the kind of stories that they value often don't involve people of color or women as the protagonists. I mean, to be honest, you also need those film lovers who are people of color and women who also want to be filmmakers. You need to give them the opportunity to make those films and act out their love of film. I don't think it's solely on the audience. To be honest, I think it's mostly on the industry. But it's also a business, and so people need to also go see those movies. But then it's a chicken and egg thing. It's like, well, will people see these movies who live in a place where it's not New York or LA, where it's like a limited showing, or if you're not advertising it very heavily.
Or even advertising it correctly, like actually reaching out to the right people and meeting them in the right places.
Right, exactly. I guess there's just so many factors that I don't think there's just one. There's a lot of different moving parts there.
Like, there are a ton of moving parts. Like, when you think of the people who, you know, help make a movie or a TV show a success, like you have the audience, you've got filmmakers like Ava DuVernay, but there's another voice that often isn't mentioned, and that's people who are like in the movies. In this case, in the clip I'm about to play for you next, it's an actress, actually one of my favorite actresses. So this is a clip that comes from Vulture TV podcast from Panoply. And in this particular clip, the team at Vulture is talking to the star of ABC's smash hit, How to Get Away with Murder, Queen Viola Davis.
Yes, she is queen.
She is queen. So on How to Get Away with Murder, Viola plays Annalise Keating, who is a defense attorney and professor who, like, is caught up in these love polygons, and she's leading, like, six or seven double lives, like, all of the time. And in this clip, Viola talks about how she uses her role as a lead actor on her series to influence the creative choices of Peter Nowak, who is the showrunner of How to Get Away with Murder. So the other voice you're going to hear in this clip, in addition to Viola's, is Matthew Zoller-Seitz of the Vulture TV podcast.
One of the things I always tell Pete is there are times when people write television based on what you've seen before in other TV shows. For instance, she's a lead character, she's sexual. It's got to be someone like, I don't know, I'm just going to throw a name, Vanessa Williams. Mm-hmm. She's got to be someone who has the body. She's got to be someone who's desirable. She's got to look like this. She's got to sound like this. And my experience with that is, says who? That's not the people in my life. I know women who are black widows who probably size 26. And they've had lots of men, and they have lots of secrets, you know? And I just feel like I'm always, at least in my way, forcing him to take more chances with storylines like that. Why can't you do that? What are you going to sacrifice? You're going to sacrifice an OMG moment? What if it's an OMG moment that's a smaller OMG moment? Maybe it's just something that moves people just a little bit, gives people just a little bit of a glimpse of her pathology.
Talking about those oh my God moments, that's something that network television has really gotten very, very good at. Those kinds of shows where more happens in an episode than might have happened in a whole season of the show 10 years ago.
Exactly.
Do you ever worry that the audience will get worn out or that you're going to run out of ideas or that it's going to become
Absolutely.
Monotonous? I mean, it seems like...
Absolutely, I do. It's not within my control. I'm an actor. I try to do my part to the best of my ability. And I try to influence to the best of my ability. And the rest is left up to the powers that be. But I do feel it's like someone said about the show. I remember I saw the show when I was younger and I loved it on Broadway. It was a musical. Loved it. And the reviews came out and they kind of tore it apart. There were some things that they really loved about it, but they tore it apart. And I thought, oh my God, were they looking at the same show? And I remember someone saying, Viola, all those things are true that they said in that review. The bad things are true, but it's still great. And that's kind of how I feel about How to Get Away with Murder. I mean, I know that people say there's a lot going on or whatever, but I think what it does right cannot be ignored. It can't be. Listen, me being cast as Annalise alone, stop, exclamation point, is OMG. You know, when people just kind of nod their heads and do that, I'm like, okay, you name an example of you seeing anything like that on network television. The fact that they cast a woman who's dark-skinned and 50, who is my size, my everything, taking off a wig in an episode, doing all of those things, what it does right is worth a whole lot.
Yeah, I feel like that wig moment is probably the most iconic moment from that show. I just remember it so vividly and being like, whoa. This is happening on a network TV show right now.
Yeah.
On ABC.
Yeah. I mean, just to describe it, there's a moment, a pivotal moment in the first season of How to Get Away with Murder, which I devoured like potato chips, where you see Annalise, Viola Davis, in her bedroom. And this is a woman who's always perfectly put together. Like, I think this woman has a different designer like wool coat on every single day of the week for every single one of her court appearances. And she takes off her wig and her false eyelashes and her makeup and sits in her bedroom and like has this moment with herself. I had never seen anything like that in my entire life.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I've definitely seen it, but not with a Black woman and not right. in that context.
Yeah.
And just when you think about all of the backstory and history of what a Black woman's hair means to them, what the makeup means, and just the dramatic way in which she takes it off. Mm-hmm. And then I think it's like immediately, not undercut, but it's just the funny part that comes after is her husband comes in the room.
Bonnie just told me you got the girl out on bail.
Just tell me you didn't take out a second mortgage to pay for it.
I came close, but we figured out another way. Sam?
Yeah.
Why is your penis on a dead girl's phone?
That's how it goes. Yeah. It's like there's that long undressing and just like stripping down of all of her emotions and her feelings. And then she whips out that like killer line. It's just so perfect.
Well, it's also kind of like what she's talking about in the clip. It's like you have the OMG moment for people who like needed to see that in that space at that time, where yeah. just seeing her take her wig off, like her straight haired wig, and seeing her like short, what we call a TWA, teeny weeny afro, mm-hmm. like just her, like a couple inches of her natural hair, that to me was so revolutionary. So that to me made me go, oh my God. But then it's followed by like the traditional
soapy.
Yeah, this traditional soapy OMG moment where she's like, you know, where she's asking about, you know, dick pics. Like on a dead girl's phone.
Yeah, it's just those little moments of like cultural specificity, I think, that you can pinpoint in shows mm-hmm. like How to Get Away with Murder and even Empire, which takes it to a whole nother level. But there's always these like just moments of saying things that a white audience wouldn't necessarily know.
Yeah.
And just letting it happen. And then if you don't get it, you don't get it. Yeah. Or you ask someone.
Exactly.
But, like, it's great. If there's one thing that I appreciate about where we are with Black television specifically, I mean, we still got a very long way to go, but it's that now we're getting more of those moments like that.
Mm-hmm.
We've made some strides.
We've definitely made some strides. Well, Aisha, thank you so much. You've been a fantastic guest.
Thank you.
I'm so glad that you came here and you talked to us today.
It was very fun.
Thank you. I'm so glad. That's kind of the thing that we go for here. To recap the clips featured on the show today, the interview with Larry Wilmore was from Slate's Represent with Aisha Harris, our guest. The conversation about Mad Max and feminism was from the Film Spotting podcast. Commentary on silence in film was from KCRW's The Treatment. And the OMG moment with Viola Davis was from the Vulture TV podcast. This episode was produced by Kate Parkinson Morgan, Sarah Abdurrahman, and myself. It was edited by Annie Rose Strasser. Sampler's theme music was made by Mike Avellian, and our ad music was made by Mark Phillips. The show was mixed by Austin Thompson and Ian Scott. Sampler is a production of Gimlet Media.